morning and welcome to Occupy the Airwaves. Okay, this is the third week in a row I have a terrorist attack to talk about. The Ukrainian offensive is not going well because they were not prepared and they lost a lot of people, soldiers, and equipment. So what did they do to make up for the military loss? They blew up a dam and put thousands and thousands of civilians plus animals' lives at risk. Flooded out an entire section of eastern Ukraine, which is now considered Russia. When you look at the newspapers, the mass media in America, they call it Ukraine, but that oblast voted to join Russia, so the Russians consider it part of Russia. And Russia was in control of the dam, trying to operate it effectively. The Ukrainians blew it up. They had attacked it with HIMARS and weakened it last year, but apparently what they did this time is first they opened up dams above this particular dam that they controlled and put so much water into the dam that it was under a lot of pressure and it was already weakened from the HIMARS starts last year. And then they floated mines down the river and blew it up and the water, the dam broke and the water got out and it killed a lot of animals and I don't know about how many people, flooded out Russian soldiers, threatened the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant because the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant relies on energy and water from that particular dam to make sure that it doesn't have a nuclear meltdown. Now, the Zaporizhia power plant is the one that the Ukrainians keep bombing, and the media tells you that Russia is bombing theirself because the Russian troops are in that power plant. What the American media tells you, the mighty Wurlitzer propaganda, it's not just America, it's also Reuters, which is a British propaganda firm, and AFP, which is French propaganda. But all European and American propaganda will tell you nonsense like the Russians are bombing their own troops in their own power plant in order to have a nuclear disaster in their own territory. Because that makes sense. Not. I don't understand how anyone can believe this nonsense, but apparently there are people that if they hear the TV man tell them something or they read it on their computer or their phone, when the ruling class pushes news into the front of their face while they're trying to go on their phone or their computer, well, it must be true then, right? Because Russia, of course, would bomb their own troops and their own power plant in their own territory. Sure, that makes sense. And the Russians would blow up their own dam that they are controlling that helps to make sure that that other nuclear power plant doesn't melt down and contaminate all of eastern Ukraine and, parts of Russia too. Because that makes sense. No, it doesn't. It doesn't make sense. It's like, oh, the Russians blew up their own pipelines because they didn't want to send gas anymore. Well, number one, the pipeline valves were shut already because of the sanctions. Germany put sanctions on the gas, so the pipelines were shut off. They weren't delivering gas anyhow, but they were full of gas. When the United States blew up the gas, it was the worst environmental nightmare that we have had. All that methane went up in the atmosphere. They're killing cows in Netherlands and France. They're killing hundreds of thousands of cows because they say that cow farts put too much methane into the atmosphere. They're killing animals. In the meantime, the United States blows up a pipeline and dumps tons of methane into the atmosphere, and the entire media is quiet about it. Oh, that methane? No, that's not a threat to the environment. Cows are a threat, but not blowing up a pipeline. I mean, it makes no sense. If Russia wanted to flood their own territory and their own troops, because the troops were on the bank of the river that got flooded, and cut off water to Crimea, which that was one of the first things that Russia did when they entered the Civil War last year, was they turned on the water to Crimea, which Ukraine had shut off for 8 years. The Russians went in and turned the water back on, but now the water's off again because the Ukrainians blew up the dam. But the media is telling the gullible and the people who aren't able to think for themselves, oh yeah, the Russians blew up their own dam because they didn't want Crimea to have water. Really? And they wanted to drown their own troops. Really? And they wanted to blow up their own nuclear power plant. Really? Does this really make sense? No, it doesn't. But why on earth would the media even tell you such nonsense? So I'm going to read from Caitlin Johnston, who gives 15 reasons why the media spouts such nonsense. I mean, you know that they can't all be that stupid. they can't all be stupid enough to believe what they are telling you with a straight face. And especially, I don't know if you've ever seen it, where people do compilations of, you know, 50 talking heads all saying the same thing in the same phrases, but they're doing it in their own special way that they learned in drama school in high school. Oh, this is a problem. This is a problem. This is a problem. Yeah, that kind of thing. So anyhow, why did Ukraine throw their men into, and remember, most of these men are just snatched off the streets and kidnapped and thrown, handed a rifle and sent off to the front line. Why would they do that when they weren't ready? Well, this is from simplicicus76.substack.com, and he is quoting some Russian named Vladislav Shurgin, or maybe it's a Ukrainian. I'm not sure if it's Ukrainian or Russian, but this is a quote. On Friday, the command of the armed forces of Ukraine turned to Zelensky with a request to stop the offensive and ask Western curators for an additional 21 days to restore the combat command and control system, accumulate supplies and weapons. With the same request, it went through operational channels to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, but in response received an order to continue the offensive. That is the demand of the U.S. president himself, who needs a result from the Ukrainians, a military defeat of the Russians, and not an explanation of the reasons for their failures, unquote. So in other words, the Ukrainian military did not want to launch this doomed offensive, and they tried to get out of it, and they asked their American owners, please, can we please at least have 3 more weeks so we can get more ready? And the American owners said, no, you have to do it. We don't care about your excuses. We just want you to obey orders and go do it. So they obeyed orders, they lost a bunch of people, and then they blew up a dam. That's just how they do. Anyhow, so like I said, my third week of reporting a terrorist attack, and then also what wasn't reported was that they had tried to get out of doing this, but they were told to do it anyhow, and the Western media totally ignoring all the doomed offensive of the Ukrainians. And why did they do that? So I'm going to read from CaitlinJohnston.com, and this article is called 15 Reasons Why Mass Media Employees Act Like Propagandists. She says, if you watch Western news media with a critical eye, you eventually notice how their reporting consistently aligns with the interests of the U.S. centralized empire, in almost the same way you'd expect them to if they were government-run propaganda outlets. The New York Times has reliably supported every war the U.S. has waged. Western mass media focus overwhelmingly on foreign protests against governments the United States dislikes, while paying far less attention to widespread protests against U.S.-aligned governments. Yeah, for instance, in the Netherlands, they're not happy that they're having to have their cows killed and their farms shut down so that refugees can be housed on the farmland. So they're having big old protests in the Netherlands, but the United States media doesn't cover it? Nah. What about the Yellow Vest movement in France or the recent riots in France? Does the U.S. media cover it? Nah, not so much. Back to Caitlin. The only time Trump was universally showered with praise by the mass media was when he bombed Syria. Well, the only time Biden has been universally slammed by the mass media was when he withdrew from Afghanistan. U.S. media did such a good job deceitfully marrying Saddam Hussein to the September 11th attacks in the minds of the public in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq that 7 in 10 Americans still believed he was connected to 9/11 months after the war began. Probably some of them still do. And what's interesting about that particular propaganda piece is originally the propaganda was the September 11th attacks were 19 hijackers run by a Saudi living in a cave in Afghanistan, and that is why we had to go destroy and attack and invade and occupy Afghanistan for 20 years. Because a Saudi living in a cave directed 19 other Saudis to destroy the World Trade Center's and the Pentagon. 3 World Trade Centers. And the beauty of propaganda is most Americans only remember 2. They don't remember Building 7 at all. And then exactly 1 week after 9/11 came the anthrax attacks, which scared far more people around here than the 9/11 attacks did. Because around here, people are like, well, New York is really far away. They aren't going to come bomb Carbondale, right? But the anthrax thing scared everybody because it was all over the country. And I worked in the ER, and people would come to the ER with their little bags of powder that they found somewhere or the other, and they would be like, I've been exposed to anthrax, I'm going to die. People were terrorized by the anthrax attacks. And we were told that Iraq was responsible for the anthrax. That was how the propaganda was in September 2001. That is what the propaganda was. Saudi in Afghanistan, 9/11. Saddam Hussein in Iraq, anthrax. But then, for some reason, I think maybe because the press was a little bit less controlled 22 years ago, and they attacked the National Enquirer, and they killed at least one reporter there at the National Enquirer. So the media kind of reported that, you know what, this isn't actually Iraqi anthrax. This is actually American anthrax. They didn't bring up that bioweapons research is illegal, but they did bring up that this was bioweapon grade anthrax and it came from America. And then they fingered one guy and said he did it. And then the guy proved, I didn't do this. So then they fingered another guy, and that guy conveniently committed suicide. So there was never a trial. There was never evidence. There was just an accusation. But I digress. I just think it's amazing that for probably 3 weeks after the anthrax attack started, they blamed it on Iraq and Saddam Hussein because they already had plans to invade Iraq, you know, clear back in 2001, obviously. I mean, the buildup only started a year later. Obviously, it was already planned. Anyhow, the propaganda was that Saddam Hussein was responsible for the anthrax, but as soon as it came out that that was American bioweapon, not an Iraqi bioweapon, that all got dropped down the memory hole, and they started in on Saddam Hussein is connected to 9/11 instead. So the propaganda totally changed, and everybody fell for it. I would say 95% of Americans just forgot all about the whole anthrax attacks and Saddam Hussein blah, 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 and switched over to, oh no, Saddam Hussein was friends with Osama bin Laden, which is like a joke. Obviously, they were not friends. Iraq had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. They were enemies. But anyhow, it doesn't matter. That's what the propaganda did. So I just think it's amazing how people can be totally terrorized. People were totally terrorized by the anthrax attacks, but then they totally forgot about it because the propaganda stopped. But the 9/11 attacks, which people mostly, the rest of flyover America, wasn't that worried about, they're still talking about it now, many times, because of the propaganda push was so powerful that it has lasted all this time. So something that really scared Americans has been forgotten, but something that didn't scare Americans is still being used to push for more and more and more wars. It's actually amazing to me how easy it is to propagandize people, but they do it through the media, and that is what this article is about. I digress, sorry. CaitlinJohnstone.com. So to go on with Caitlin. That this extreme bias occurs is self-evident and indisputable to anyone who pays attention, but why and how it happens is harder to see. The uniformity is so complete and so consistent that when people first begin noticing these patterns, it's common for them to assume the media must be controlled by a small, centralized authority, much like the state media of more openly authoritarian governments. But if you actually dig into the reasons why the media act the way they act, that isn't really what you find. Instead, what you find is a much larger, much less centralized network of factors which tips the scales of media coverage to the advantage of the U.S. empire and the forces which benefit from it. Some of it is indeed conspiratorial in nature and happens in secret, but most of it is essentially out in the open. Well, I know I used to listen to Tom Hartman on that local radio station, I forget what it was, and he said because he had a talk show, he got the talking points every day, 4 o'clock in the morning. They sent out to all the radio talk show hosts in the entire country the talking points of the day. This is what we're going to talk about today. Today we're going to talk about, in the main media, it's going to be the dam broke, right? Or the dam was destroyed. We're going to blame it on Russia, by the way. And in celebrity news, I don't know, someone got married or someone got divorced, I don't know. I don't pay any attention to my computer or my phone when they try to push news on me, and I definitely don't watch the TV news. So there you go. All right, so here are 15 of those factors. 1, media ownership. And this is a tweet from Julian Assange before he got thrown in the dungeon because he went against the dominant narrative. New rule. Every time a news organization produces fake news, name the controlling oligarchs or CEO. NBC, Brian Roberts. CBS, Redstones. CNN, Jay Zucker and Jay Bakis. New Yorker, Reddit, Wired, all owned by Newhouse. Daily Beast, Diller. Fox, WSJ, Murdoch's. I think Disney bought it now, though. But anyhow, this is from before they threw him in the dungeon, so it's a little dated. New York Times, Schultzburgers. Washington Post, Bezos. Okay, but it doesn't really matter if the Murdoch's and the Schultzburgers own those outlets now or not, because the propaganda remains the same, actually. So, the most obvious point of influence in the mass media is the fact that such outlets tend to be owned and controlled by plutocrats, that's the same, whose wealth and power are built upon the status quo they benefit from. Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, which he bought in 2013 from the also immensely wealthy Graham family. And there was like even a movie about Katharine Graham and how wonderful she was. The New York Times has been run by the same family for over a century. But I think it's owned by other people now, but maybe I'm wrong. Rupert Murdoch owns a vast international media empire whose success is largely owed to the U.S. government agencies with whom he is closely intertwined. Owning media has in and of itself historically been an investment that can generate immense wealth, like having a license to print your own money, as Canadian television magnate Roy Thompson once put it. Does this mean that wealthy media owners are standing over their employees and telling them what to report from day to day? No. But it does mean they control who will run their outlet, which means they control who will be doing the hiring of its executives and editors, who control the hiring of everyone else at the outlet. Rupert Murdoch never stood in the newsroom announcing the talking points and war propaganda for the day, but you've got a snowball's chance in hell of securing a job with the Murdoch press if you're an anti-imperialist. Which takes us to another related point. If you believe something different, you wouldn't be sitting where you're sitting. In a contentious 1996 discussion between Noam Chomsky and British journalist Andrew Marr, Chomsky derided the false image that mainstream journalists have of themselves as a crusading profession who are adversarial and stand up against power, saying it's almost impossible for a good journalist to do it in any meaningful way in the mass media of the Western world. Which, of course, is why the good journalists now have their own Substacks or their own websites, because they don't last long in mainstream media. Back to Caitlin. How can you know that I'm self-censoring? How can you know that journalists are, Matt objected. I'm not saying you're self-censoring, Chomsky replied. I'm sure you believe everything you're saying. But what I'm saying is, if you believe something different, you wouldn't be sitting where you're sitting. There you go. They just hire people, lackeys and flacks, who are down with the plan, who are cool with the program, who just believe all the nonsense, even without being paid to believe it. That's how they get hired. In a 1997 essay, Chomsky added that the point is they wouldn't be there unless they had already demonstrated that no one has to tell them what to write, because they are going to say the right thing anyhow. 3. Journalists learn pro-establishment groupthink without being told. This you-wouldn't-be-sitting-where-you're-sitting effect isn't just some personal working theory of Chomsky's. Journalists who've spent time in the mass media have publicly acknowledged that this is the case in recent years, saying that they learn very quickly what kinds of output would help and hinder their movement up the career ladder without needing to be explicitly told. During his second presidential primary run in 2019, Senator Bernie Sanders enraged the mass media with some comments he made accusing the Washington Post of biased reporting against him. Sanders' claim was entirely correct. During the hottest and most tightly contested point in the 2016 presidential primary, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting noted that WAPO had published no fewer than 16 smear pieces about Sanders in the span of 16 hours. That's amazing. Sanders pointing out this blatantly obvious fact sparked an emotional controversy about bias in the media, which yielded a few quality testimonials from people in the know. Among these were former MSNBC reporter Crystal Ball and former Daily Caller White House correspondent Sanjar Anjetti, who explained the subtle pressures to adhere to a groupthink orthodoxy that they'd experienced in a segment with The Hill's online show Rising. Quote, there are certain pressures to stay in good with the establishment to maintain the access that is the lifeblood of political journalism, Ball said. So what do I mean? Let me get an example from my own career, since everything I'm saying here really frankly applies to me too. Back in early 2015 at MSNBC, I did a monologue that some of you may have seen, pretty much begging Hillary Clinton not to run. I said her elite ties were out of step with the party and the country, that if she ran, she would likely be the nominee and then would go on to lose. No one censored me. I was allowed to say it. But afterwards, the Clinton people called and complained to the MSNBC top brass and threatened not to provide any access during the upcoming campaign. I was told that I could still say what I wanted, but I would have to get any Clinton-related commentary cleared with the president of the network. Now, being a human, interested in maintaining my job, I'm certain I did less critical Clinton commentary after that than I otherwise maybe would have, unquote. This is something a lot of people don't understand, said Njeti. It's not necessarily that someone tells you how to do your coverage. It's that if you were to do your coverage that way, you would not be hired at that institution. So it's like if you did not already fit within this framework, then the system is designed to not give you a voice. And if you necessarily did do all that, all of the incentive structures around your pay, around your promotion, around your colleagues that are slapping you on the back, that would all disappear. So it's a system of reinforcement, which makes it so that you wouldn't go down that path in the first place, unquote. Right. And again, it's not necessarily intentional, Baugh added. It's that those are the people that you're surrounded with. So there becomes a groupthink. And look, you're aware of what you're going to be rewarded for and what you're going to be punished for or not rewarded for. Like, that definitely plays in the mind, whether you want to or not. That's a reality, unquote. During the same controversy, former MSNBC producer Jeff Cohen published an article in Salon titled, Memo to Mainstream Journalists, Can the Phony Outrage? Bernie is Right About Bias, in which he described the same groupthink experience. And this is Jeff Cohen. It happens because of groupthink. It happens because top editors and producers know, without being told, which issues and sources are off limits. No orders need be given, for example, for rank-and-file journalists to understand that the business of the corporate boss or top advertisers is off-limits, short of criminal indictments. No memo is needed to achieve the narrowness of perspective, selecting all the usual experts from all the usual think tanks to say all the usual things. Think Tom Friedman, or Barry McCaffrey, or Neera Tanden, or any of the elite club members who've been proven to be absurdly wrong time and time again about national or global affairs, unquote. So you see, it doesn't matter that they're wrong, they are approved, so they get on, and where people who are not approved don't get on. Matt Taibbi also jumped into the controversy to highlight the media groupthink effect, published an article with Rolling Stone about the way journalists come to understand what will and will not elevate their mass media careers. So at that time, he was an employee of a major newspaper. Now he's on Substack, I think, or no, now he has his own racket. Because he quit saying and thinking everything he was supposed to say and think. Oops, you're out of here. So this is Matt Taibbi. Reporters Watch is good investigative journalism about serious structural problems dies on the vine, while mountains of column space are devoted to trivialities like Trump tweets and our simplistic partisan storylines. Nobody needs to pressure anyone. We all know what takes will and will not earn attaboys in newsrooms. And she says, and it's probably worth noting here that Taibbi is no longer with Rolling Stone. 4. Mass media employees who don't comply with their groupthink get worn down and pressured out. Reporter, and then she has a tweet. Reporter quits NBC, citing network support for endless war. And this is a quote. I'm not sure who this guy is because, like I said, I don't watch the TV news. And I got news in air quotes. And I would assert that in many ways, NBC just began emulating the national security state itself, busy and profitable. No wars won, but the ball is kept in play. Oh, I guess this is William Arkin, because she writes, journalists either learn how to do the kind of reporting that will advance their careers in the mass media, or they don't learn. And they either remain marginalized and unheard of, or they get worn down and quit. NBC reporter William Arkin resigned from the network in 2019, criticizing NBC in an open letter for being consistently in favor of policies that just spell more conflict and more war, and complaining that the network had begun emulating the national security state itself. And boy, are they pushing this war in Ukraine. The military in Ukraine is like, we don't want to do this. But the media and the State Department and the president are like, oh, you are going to do this. We paid a bunch of money. You are going to go fight that war, and we don't want to hear any excuses why you don't want to do it. Because they want, again, to empty Ukraine of the last Ukrainian. Because the Ukrainians, that's their land, and BlackRock and Monsanto and other corporations in America want it. And they want it, but they don't want the Ukrainians. So when they talk about, we're going to fight this war to the last Ukrainian, they are serious. They are serious about that. You should take that. When they say that, believe that. Everything else they say is a lie. But believe it when they say they're going to fight that war to the last Ukrainian, because that is what they want to do. Arkin said he often found himself a lone voice in scrutinizing various aspects of the U.S. war machine, saying he argued endlessly with MSNBC about all things national security for years. We have contributed to turning the world national security into this sort of political story, he wrote. I find it disheartening that we do not report the failures of the generals and national security leaders. I find it shocking that we essentially condone continued American bumbling in the Middle East and now Africa through our ho-hum reporting, unquote. Well, it's not American bumbling. It's what you call American imperialism. That's what you call it, not bumbling. You don't accidentally destroy country after country after country. You don't accidentally bomb people's infrastructure and their hospitals and their weddings and their funerals. You don't accidentally bomb hospitals and clinics and doctor's offices and schools. You don't accidentally kill 20 million people in 70 years. It's not bumbling. It's on purpose. Please. All right. Well, you know what? That bumbling, he calls it bumbling. That's why he lasted so long. Because I would never get hired, because I don't call it bumbling. I call it deliberate imperialism. So there you go. Sometimes the pressure is much less subtle. Pulitzer-winning journalist Chris Hedges left the New York Times after being issued a formal written reprimand by the paper for criticizing the Iraq invasion in a speech at Rockford College, realizing that he would either have to stop speaking publicly about what he believed or he'd be fired. And this is probably one of the first cancel cultures, right? Because he didn't write it in the paper. He said it on his off time when he was not being paid. And this is what cancel culture is. You cannot leave groupthink at any time. Not just when you're officially talking on your talking head job on the network news, but even if you are posting on Twitter or giving a speech or whatever, talking with your family, whatever, if you step out of line, cancel culture gets you fired nowadays. Because you are supposed to stay in character at all points. You can't just, you know, toe the line when you're being paid at your 8-hour job. You have to toe the line 24 hours a day, no matter where you are, or you're canceled. You're out. That's the kind of totalitarian nonsense that people, and not just journalists, but everybody, actresses, actors, you know, anyone that has any kind of say can lose their job, but so can ordinary people. Ordinary people are also getting canceled for like, yeah, I don't think so. You know, I don't go along with that. teacher, he said, blah, blah, blah. Oh, well, you're out. But that's what it's like. It's like a nation of snitches that with the power to destroy people's lives. So as Hedges said, when faced with that, he said, either I muzzled myself to pay fealty to my career, or I spoke out and realized that my relationship with my employer was terminal, he said in 2013. And so at that point, I left before they got rid of me. But I knew that, you know, I wasn't going to be able to stay, unquote. So he left before he got fired. But he would have gotten fired. He would have got, we call it nowadays, canceled. But in 2003, again, it was a different time in 2003. The propaganda was overwhelming, but every once in a while, you could see a glimmer of truth, but nah, that didn't happen anymore. Mass media employees who step too far out of line get fired. And then they talk about somebody named Matt Hill, who got fired for speaking at the United Nations for the Palestinians. Boop, you're out. This measure doesn't need to be applied often, but it happens enough for people with careers in media to get the message. Like when Phil Donahue was fired for MSNBC for his opposition to the Bush administration's warmongering in the lead up to the Iraq invasion, despite having the best ratings of any show on the network. Or the latest one is Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson had the highest ratings of any news show on cable news, but he didn't toe the party line, so he got fired. He got fired like immediately, no 2 weeks notice for him. And so you can see what happens, and you can see what happens. We'll soak in every other employee of every media outlet. You think they're going to go ahead and say something they're not supposed to say, something their owners don't want them to say, then get fired and end up, what, out on the streets living out of your car? Yeah, they ain't going to do that. So anyhow, there's more to this, but I'm running out of time. So that's the end of Occupy the Airwaves. See you next week.